I'd like to start by thanking you for being here. As Sokozan often does, just let you know that we really appreciate all the support you show through your contributions and your participation. There's a great deal, and I mean a great deal, that goes into keeping this functioning, operating up and running, just being able to continue to make these teachings available, let alone the maintenance of the building. So anything you can offer is always greatly received and appreciated. And again, if nothing else, your greatest gift is your participation in these teachings and practices. So I'm going to talk about Dhyana Paramita tonight, meditation paramita. And of the five paramitas the four we've talked about so far, this one definitely, I think, carries the most weight for me. I think that of all the paramitas, of all six, it's meditation that I'm very magnetized by. I think that's part of why I was so magnetized by Sokozan's teachings, that there's not a talk that we don't talk about Dhyana Paramita, meditation paramita. And there's a reason for that, because the vehicle of our practice is meditation, that the foundation of Buddhism rides upon the vehicle of meditation. That vehicle is fueled by the teacher and it's fueled by the lineage. But without that practice, a lot of what we tend to do is more, I was watching gymnastics today, more gymnastics. It's like we swing upon the concepts and we elaborate and we build and they become very complicated, which is wonderful. But it is the paramita that really takes those concepts and shows why we're studying them. It actually opens us up to the reality of the world of which these concepts are trying to express. And while I say that was what magnetized me to studying with Sokozan, maybe initially to some part, is also what caused a lot of resistance. I recall my first time coming down, our all-day meditations used to be from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. And there was no work period. It was a 3 hour sit in the morning. We'd sit from 3 until noon. And then I want to say we started sitting again around 1 or 1:30. And then we'd sit until 3:30. We'd have tea. Sokozan would give his talk. We'd have supper. And we'd end the night by sitting for another 2 hours. So we were sitting around 7 hours at a time. And I remember the first time coming here, I realized I was trying to figure out how I wanted to practice Buddhism. And I was like, I don't want to practice Zen. They sit too much. Vivid memory, don't want to come back. It just sits too much. I don't like that. And then the next month I was back, and the next month I was back, and then a few years later I didn't leave. But meditation is a practice that is really unlike any other, because it doesn't provide us a sort of security net that so many other ways of perceiving the world provide us. Because when we begin to sit down and practice, we really are helpless. It's a difficult practice. And it's interesting when we look at the frustration we have with practice and the difficulty we have getting to the cushion or staying on the cushion or looking at the mind. And then you hear something like Dogen saying it's a practice of comfort and ease. Or Sokozan saying once, maybe twice, that meditation is the most luxurious thing you can do. And it's such a sharp contrast to our initial experience of meditation. And so how is it that the struggle we experience on the cushion can be described as a practice of comfort and ease, or the most luxurious thing that we can do? And initially, it's not. It's not. But the luxury shows up when we actually begin to hear the instruction that's being given, which is you don't have to perform anything. There's actually not an activity to accomplish. The luxury is that for the brief period of time when we sit down, there are no demands except for the ones we create. And therefore, we have this luxurious opportunity where we can't really be evaluated. Just sitting there. That's not to say that the thoughts aren't painful or that the emotions aren't rugged or rough, but it's one of the few times in our life where when we begin to see our expectations and see them for what they are, we actually have an opportunity to not do anything. No production necessary other than the production that occurs spontaneously. So there's a lot of ways I could talk about this and have been lucky to hear Sokazan talk about this so often. But it's also something I recognize the most intimate exchanges around meditation have been when I've had an opportunity to clarify my practice through asking Sokazan questions, which I've done a lot of. And so I would see or ask if there's any questions around the practice of meditation, this thing that Sokazan is saying every day, train your mind, return to the cushion, sit more. Because it's easy to get caught into this idea, this habit of just asking questions of, this person said this and I didn't like it. How do I fix it? How do I do this better? How do I have a better job? How do I have a better relationship? And we never actually turn back in and say, do I even understand the practice that is being given to me? What is this? So if there are questions about meditation, I would do my best to respond to those.
You know. Tomorrow we're going to, some of us are going to Grand Rapids. Sokazan is giving a talk for an all-day retreat called Why Meditate. What do you say about Why Meditate, Vine?
I get a lot of cheat codes. And so Sokazan, I already heard him respond to this, so he responded perfectly. And he said, don't meditate. And that is something we should keep in mind strongly. That when we look at meditation, we need to meditate. Nobody else needs to meditate. It's the same thing with any of these teachings. Don't appropriate them and force them on others. You need to CCC. Other people don't need to CCC. You need to observe. Other people can do whatever they need to do. So why meditate? I'd be very tentative to try to push that on anybody. And yet at the same time, if somebody came forward and asked about it, usually what brings us to meditation is that there's some understanding that the way in which we're approaching our negativity is not helpful. It's actually just causing more chaos. So why any of us might meditate is going to be very unique, but some level of it is we want to understand the suffering that we've been struggling with our entire lives. We want to do more than just create temporary stability or temporary relief. We want to actually be able to understand what is this suffering that continues to rear its head on a daily basis? And what does it mean to live a life of sanity or compassion in the midst of a world that is full of suffering? I liked his answer. Don't meditate.
You just presented a lot of questions, one of which was don't CCC. What is CCC?
Sokazan's teachings on communication, cooperating, and collaborating. The original version was communicate, cooperate, and compassionate. And some of you may recall compassionation, and it's now collaborate. So the communication, I feel pretty strongly about this. And I think it's an unfortunate misunderstanding that we feel that in order for the communication to occur, it requires some sort of reciprocity from somebody else. And that is really more about results. If you want a fruitful conversation, then there's mutuality and you both come to some consensus. Whereas communication, as with most of Sokazan's teachings, is about an intention. It's not about getting somebody to respond a particular way. It's about having the vulnerability to work with the situation, which may not be receiving the results you want, but you intend to be clear, you intend to be direct. You're also very considerate of what's in front of you, and you don't try to force anything. So in your intention to be direct, you may recognize that it's not helpful to be direct. In your intention to articulate, you may recognize it's better to just ask questions and receive and to listen. So communication isn't a formula of activity, it's an intention to work with the situation as it arises.
Shoto Vine, how does meditation help us to understand the second noble truth?
Well, I think it first begins to shine a light on all the assumptions, on the conditioned responses, on the impulses that we take for granted as true. It's hard to see that kind of conditionality, the habituation, without at least some stillness in which to look at the movement. So without taking that time to sit down, without taking that time to intend to be still and to receive, we function so heavily on autopilot. It's like such a lubricated system that we believe it before we've even seen what it is. And so the second noble truth is, so because I was talking about this evening, desire, wanting things to be different than they are, we have to begin to see the demand. We often don't see the demand because it's so apparent to our self-centeredness to be true or to be valid or deserving that we don't even consider it as a demand. We just assume that that needs to be the case. So the meditation practice seems to begin to bring our attention to these conditioned interactions.
Bowing. With Sokazan's instruction on meditation to just observe, is there some kind of tension inherent in that, like an inactivity?
I wouldn't say there is a tension inherent in it. There's nothing inherent in it. The attention is projected. The projection occurs when you're given the instruction, and then you endeavor to accomplish that, or you endeavor to refute that, or you wrestle with it, or you try to apply it. So intention doesn't necessarily have to have any tension in it at all. It doesn't have to have a tension in it. But our demand for results or progress usually means we take those teachings and try to create some sort of warfare or chaos by applying those teachings. So it's enough to not understand necessarily what that is, but we intend to return to sitting there. We intend to observe. We intend to receive. But the intention is not diminished when we notice the warfare. The intention is not diminished when we go into daydreaming.
Hondo.
Hondo Bai, how can we prioritize awareness?
Maybe there's more to it, but the simple way would be to prioritize your meditation practice to some extent. And I don't mean in an aggressive way where you cloister yourself from the world, at least not indefinitely. Temporarily would probably do some of that. I appreciate that we don't get a tremendous amount of instruction as far as post-meditation. We get some, but it really goes to show that meditation and awareness practice is not like a weapon or a tool that we can wield on the world. We prioritize our sitting practice. And I think that awareness, which we don't get to claim ownership of, and we're probably not even able to discriminate, seems to permeate very naturally. And I don't think any of us can say that from the time we started meditating till now that we don't notice any differences, although that's not the goal of what we're doing. But you also can't say, here's where I started actively being more aware. It's not often showing up as points in time. And yet we see that, yeah, maybe we do listen. Maybe we're a little bit more considerate of the impulses that arise in consciousness.
On the cushion, how can we prioritize awareness? Or should we?
I think that the way in which we do that is, as Sokazan instructs us, through intention. The prioritizing of awareness, I think, occurs as soon as you sit down with the intention to receive. And we don't necessarily need to gauge the results by what happens during a period of meditation. That there's a tremendous amount of softness that we begin to develop when we stop going to war with what is arising naturally, which is not a threat. But as long as we see the mind as an ally or as a threat, meditation can be quite painful because we take what arises and we think it means something. So how we prioritize awareness in meditation, I think for the most part, is as simple as getting to the cushion. As I said at the beginning, checking back in with Sokazan, checking back in with a meditation teacher, meditation instructor. Any more?
Bien.
Bien bowing. And just a larger sense of like the population of humans. Do you think that maybe the three poisons protect people or even keep them safe from suffering in a sense?
I would say even intimately, any one of us, I don't know if you can resonate with that, but I certainly can, the way in which I've used aggression as a way to keep negative feelings away, or justifying, you know, creating isolation, a protected space, or the passion or grasping of what feels good so that I don't have to feel something bad. You know, distraction's an easy one. Like, distraction is a really easy way that works pretty well, not always, but to keep that negativity at bay. So, you know, I would say, yes, that's a pretty heavily used tool for mitigating our negativity.
You and Bowing, this may involve a bit of an assumption, but why do you want to help people see through those things to the very thing that hurts so much?
I think that it is not something I look to do universally in a way that everyone needs to see through to their true nature, at least until they've given permission or they've asked for it. I think that that's something that Sokuzan talks about, and it's not something that is new either. I can always come back to Kuei Nung, teach people the Dharma if they're ready, if not, teach them to be kind. So you have to teach to somebody's receptivity. And there's a lot to just helping someone be kind to themselves and to be kind to their world. Is it awakening? No, probably not. But to try to force some sort of practice or ideology or intention on somebody else creates far more suffering than anything else. So as with Sokuzan, it's permission. You have to have permission to take somebody or go with somebody or point somebody into that area. And that's why I don't think that there's anything more destructive than trying to teach somebody who's not asking to be taught. I think that that's, it can just be so painful. It can create so much divisiveness and actually cause people to resent the Dharma because they're being coerced or manipulated. And again, since we're doing, I like to do this sometimes, basic Buddhist teachings, I'm not saying that this is the case at all, but in classical Tibetan Buddhism, sometimes it's said that you actually become responsible for all of the karma of anyone you teach. So if you teach out of your confusion and you transmit that confusion to somebody and they further propagate that confusion, classically it's said that you are now responsible for however far that confusion reaches. I'm not saying that's the case, but it's something to reflect on, that despite our good intentions, if we are not clear about what we are being asked for, we can actually cause more disruption than help.
Bien bowing, I'm thinking of a community mindfulness center. I'm thinking of a community mindfulness center, and what is kind about a mindfulness practice? What is kind to ourselves about a mindfulness practice?
I can talk about it in the context of the people I'm seeing. So this is not an abstract situation for me. Sokuzan has me teaching mindfulness at the community college, at Battle Creek High School, Central High School, and Willard Library. And I think of Unyo was really into Maslow's hierarchy of needs a while back. And it's like the pinnacle is like self-actualization or spirituality, but without feeling safe, without feeling like you have enough to eat, you have somewhere to live. The idea of spirituality is probably not something we should be forcing on anybody. So when I meet a lot of these people, the situations they've lived through, violence, sexual assault, homelessness. I mean, there's kids going home to cars that I meet with, or going home where they might not see their parents for several days, or they don't ever want to see their parents. And so mindfulness practice in a biological sense can help regulate the nervous system, and regulating the nervous system can help them sleep better, can help them work with their emotions more clearly, can help them learn better at school. So it provides, perhaps, even though relative and momentary and temporary, some safety or some stability that might then provide them an opportunity to work with the world in a different way. So I think it is very important that we know who we are working with, and that I would never go into one of those situations with this idea that I just have to get them to see that the Buddha Dharma is the most important thing. They know that. They come in this direction when that's the case. So I think this Community Mindfulness Center is a tremendous way to support the Battle Creek community as a whole, because it's been through a lot. And if you hear Sokazan tell stories about from the time he grew up here in the 40s and 50s and what it was like, and to imagine what it's gone through in just that short period of time to now, it doesn't even sound like the same city. So there's a lot of pain.
Isan. I'm wondering if that type of, I'll call it acceptance of the good in mindfulness or in this practice, in meditation practice, is applicable to many, a lot of levels. So when, of practice. So my question for myself is, I recognize that there's a lot of times when I really do feel very comfortable in meditation. And I think the reason for that is that I get to sit and no one bugs me. No one places demands on me. And I can just sit quietly and peacefully. Sometimes think that maybe that's just not enough.
How long do you sit in, like, for a period of time? Like, how long can you maintain sitting and feel peaceful?
Everybody's dreaming.
It depends, because, well, I mean, I would daydream. It depends. Sure.
But do you sit for 4 hours regularly and feel?
No.
Yeah.
I have, but probably not that whole time. I'm not comfortable, but there's something about, I think it's a scrim of ignoring.
Yeah.
I think it's there's a veil. There's a veil that comes down and covers up the things that would be prickly if I would pay attention. So is it, how do I lift that veil? Is it important to lift the veil?
I don't know that it is. I think that when I hear you saying that, maybe the whole idea of block sitting, that's part of it. You can't maintain the facade of peacefulness for that long. I also know for me, there are periods, rare and few and far between, where life just feels pretty good. And I've learned that I don't need to go looking for the most obvious forms of suffering, but I can appreciate it. So if you're enjoying yourself, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not something you can maintain. So when it starts to crumble, which it will, these things seem to come through cyclically. Just notice if you try to grasp or bury yourself back into that good feeling of meditation. There are even times where, you know, you're going to block sit and it's going to feel good. I remember I came out of retreat this last summer and I was sitting from 8 until noon in retreat. And then I came out and then I go out to Black Stag and sit in the retreat up from 7 to 11. But I'd forgotten that. And so I thought I had to end at noon. And so I sat there for about 4.5 hours quite contentedly. And then I realized I'd wasted half an hour because I'd sat too long. But it felt good. It was very nice. It was very pleasant. For me, the big perk is I get to not have my phone on me when I block sit. And Sokazan's never corrected that. He's never said, no, take your phone in because it kind of bugs you. So that's how I feel that if you're enjoying yourself, there's nothing wrong with that. Just look to see how we try to maintain that. And then also as far as the practical side, move into those areas where you know you can't maintain peaceful meditation, which means extending the period of time in which you're sitting.
Well, I guess I mean, I know that I daydream and there are times when I get really emotional about something, and that's not comfortable. I believe what I'm asking is, so all of those things coming in and being part of the meditation practice. There's nothing to do with that.
As far as I understand and have received this practice from Soka Zan, no. And I think part of it is because we are looking to the content of our meditation to define how we're meditating. And I think that's the seduction of the duality, the seduction of the relativity, is we think that there are going to be certain thoughts or feelings or experiences or things that we can delineate that indicate how our practice is going. And I recall Soka Zan saying, you don't even know the part of your mind that's being trained when you sit down. Mm-hmm. So that desire to know, that desire to fixate or strategize is just to be included. But you can't, as far as I understand it, find any thing that arises in consciousness where you would have to say, no, that's inappropriate. That can't show up in meditation. Because if that's the case, it stops being about the awareness itself. And it goes right back into trying to get a hold of duality. Michael?
Lack of bowing. I don't quite know how to put this into words, but I'm going to try. There's been a waywardness. Like, I feel as if there's been a waywardness in my life from meditation and no meditation, and then coming back to meditation. How can I welcome awareness back into my life without turning that into a game of duality?
I wouldn't say that you need to strategize not turning it into anything. It's, again, there's some mentality that you can prevent something from occurring. Those thoughts of turning it into a game of duality, it's just another seduction. It's another thing that's trying to get your attention that says you're doing this well or you're doing this poorly. So you just your intention to be here, just the fact that you're physically showing up, that you're relating to Soka Zan, you're relating to the Sangha, you're relating to the practice, everything that comes in with that is to be included. It's not to be seen as an obstacle or a distraction. So just notice the impulse to turn it into a game. Yes.
It's hard to see it. It's hard to see. It's kind of like an eclipse. It causes me to leave. So how can I include something that I have a hard time seeing?
What is it that, in as far as you can, what would you describe what's hard to see as? How do you describe that?
It's sort of like what you said, was saying, kind of like a veil.
And so you shut down and then you pull away. Mm-hmm. Even that, that would be something to be to talk about way more in the intimate relationship with a student teacher. That's very personal. But you may even consider that there's nothing incorrect about the coming and going. There's no way to say how this should show up for you. And that's why it's helpful to have a teacher. It's helpful to have that guide to help direct you. Because if you just keep it in your own hands, which you can, and which is very comfortable, which is very safe, the way in which we filter our reality is always out of security for ourselves. It's always about protecting our identity, what we want, what feels good. And by inviting somebody else into that territory, you might have a chance of disrupting that. So instead of me commenting on that, I would just say that you may need to watch that coming and going. And I would say you would also want to examine how you want to relate to the teacher, how you would want to relate to the Sangha and to the forms. And I've seen you practice. I mean, you can do the forms. I've seen you when you first showed up, you were just sitting all the time, like all the time. So there's no doubt about it. It's not about sitting. It's about looking at the fear that seems to show up. It's a reminder I think I need regularly and get regularly from Soka Zan about nothing's threatened. And I don't know what it is that feels so profoundly threatened. And if I can step back and look at it in a little bit different light, it's like, well, of course, what's the worst that can happen? You fall into infamy. Is that the end of the world? but it feels like something much worse is going to happen. And so I think looking at that almost primal fear that shows up when we start to allow people into our territory in a way we've not before.
So Grand Bowing, what is the word Dhyana pointing to specifically compared to other ways we say meditation? Bowing?
I'm not sure. I think that Dhyana also can translate as mind. Dhyana is the root for the Chinese word Chan or Chen, which is the root for Zen, which again means mind or meditation. And to me, it has a sort of directness and an intimacy that goes all the way back and probably beyond, certainly beyond. But I think of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree and just the direct perception. I don't know that that we can say it is exactly associated with one particular style of meditation. But perhaps, I don't know, is there more to that?
So Grand Bowing, sometimes it seems like meditation can be a state of mind. Sometimes it's an ideal. Sometimes it's relative or the absolute. I'm just confused about that word and how Dhyana might point to what the paramita is. Bowing.
If I think about it in the form of a paramita or a perfection, I would see it more associated with like the direct perception of mind. So Kazan sometimes talks about how the boundary between meditation and post-meditation seems to dissolve or to drop. And at that point, he doesn't say that everything becomes meditation, but you're not necessarily making some grand differentiation. It's not the contrast of sitting and moving that defines the meditation practice. But I can't speak on it in like a global level of how everyone's breaking that word down. For us, I think of the direct perception that we're being encouraged to see, the direct perception of mind. That's why I think meditation sometimes, or shikantaza, is talked about as formless. It's a formless meditation because we're not defining it based on a structure and form. There is relative structure and form in that we hold the body still, we take an attentive attitude. But beyond that, there's not the kind of guardrails or the touchstones that we might see in other forms of meditation.
So Grand Valley, direct perception of mind, what is that?
I don't know that I can speak to that other than that's what it's, how it's been talked about, how Sokazan teaches that. I think about when he says you don't have to get rid of anything. There's nothing to fix. There's nothing to get rid of. And that coming back to that idea that we don't need to look to the content of what we're experiencing, of what's showing up to define what we're going through. So we're always looking for some form of relativity to inform us. And the closest I can come to would be saying the idea of not knowing, the intimacy of not knowing.
So Grand Bowing, why isn't there a paramita of having a teacher? Bowing?
That's a good question. And I don't want to make this assumption too heavily, but I think that in some sense it's implied that these paramitas in Buddhism, that you do have elders in the Theravadan tradition. There are elders, there are people that you might go to for guidance. In the Tibetan tradition, you have gurus, you have shifus, you have senseis, you have roshis. So I think that from the beginning that having somebody who's traversed the path has been a part of the path. And I think that along with meditation guided by a teacher is really what brings these teachings to life, what actually allows us to taste them. And I was at a breakfast this week and I met an Episcopalian, is it an oblate? Do you know somebody who's taken monastic, you know, an oblate?
An oblate?
Oblate.
Yeah.
Oblate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's somebody who's taken like monastic vows in a order of Catholicism, but it's not living a monastic life. And oblate?
Yes, it's a lay.
A lay. Practitioner. Okay. And it was kind of like, it always comes up, like, why did you leave the church or that kind of thing? And then you have to say, well, it wasn't you, it was me. And but what it comes down to is exactly what you're saying, is I never met anyone that I felt was teaching me how to be the teachings. Like I didn't find, that's not to say they weren't out there. And had I found that person, it would have redirected me. But then meeting Sokazan and going back and reading all these theologians that seemed to have some degree of intimacy, that they were just trying to articulate what they were looking at, and they were getting in a lot of trouble for it. So I think it is the teaching, the teacher-student relationship that really empowers us, or gives us a chance to see beyond our own pettiness. We don't really want to look beyond the pettiness. It probably is going to take somebody to interrupt that for us to even consider looking up. Are there any other questions this evening?
Yoka bowing. What is it about our simple meditation instruction that seems to have kept you coming back here even when you didn't want to sit 7 hours a day?
Well, sometimes I didn't, as maybe others don't have that problem. I think it was the encouragement from Sokazan to keep going. I think it was the encouragement of my own suffering that continues to keep me going, that I can pull away from the teachings, I can pull away from practice, but the suffering doesn't seem to respond well to that, the negativity. And so that does inspire me to keep coming back. And I also find that because we're not being asked to accomplish anything or maintain anything, it really empowers me to practice meditation in a very sincere way, which doesn't ask me to conform or live up to a standard. And that's kind of rare. Even this idea that we can come and go from the Zendo, which for some of us is very irritating. You're trying to sit and every 5 minutes someone's getting up from the Zendo. But we don't recognize how much respect there is in that, which allows somebody to keep practicing. Where if we, I forget the name, there's a temple outside of Madison. It's a Rinzai temple. It's one where you have to sit outside the temple for like 2 or 3 days. And it's very explicit on the website. You will not be allowed to move. You will not be allowed to adjust your posture. You will not be allowed to. You will not be allowed to. And so I imagine when you go there, it looks great. Imagine it's just like the spitting image of what you think Zen would be. But there's so much aggression in it that we actually have to fight against what's coming up to maintain that. And so therefore we see all the impulses as obstacles. We see all of them as interferences instead of having the space to not indulge them, but to actually look at them in a way that respects when we're ready to see them. So I really appreciate the respect that we are given to see our mind for ourselves without doing so in a way that looks uniform. We can close. Thank you so much. I'd like to start by thanking you for being here. As Sokazan often does, just let you know that we really appreciate all the support you show through your contributions and your participation. There's a great deal, and I mean a great deal, that goes into keeping this functioning, operating up and running, just being able to continue to make these teachings available, let alone the maintenance of the building. So anything you can offer is always greatly received and appreciated. And again, if nothing else, your greatest gift is your participation in these teachings and practices.